And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of February 17th, 2021. Today, we're joined by our co-host, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm doing well, and I'm looking forward to talking about why you should watch out for your catalytic converter, or watch your catalytic converter to make sure it doesn't disappear, along with its rare earth minerals, and also why the world needs to keep our eyes on the rare earth minerals. Listen in.
So, Mariah, interesting tidbit of news came through this past week, and that is the following thing. That there's been a rash of car thievery in the sense of people stealing the catalytic converter from cars here in our COVID strap time. I don't know. Did you see any of that?
I don't even know what to make of it. I mean, it's almost like what? It's like kind of ridiculous, but actually sort of awful because, I mean, first of all, I think they get $50 to maybe a few hundred bucks for turning these in, the earning potential from these catalytic converters that are stolen. But it costs like $1,000 to replace your catalytic converter. It's no easy fix. And of course, if you have no catalytic converter, you're letting out a bunch of really terrible emissions as
right,
well.
The catalytic converter is this box that is on your car. And I guess if you drive a Prius, you're particularly unlucky because that's one of the more valuable ones. But the catalytic converter basically is in line with the exhaust, and it contains these funky metals that you can barely pronounce of palladium, rhodium, and platinum. So the way the thing works is it's a honeycomb of with these metals coated on it, and the exhaust gas goes through it, and evidently the platinum and rhodium and whatnot catalyze a reaction, a chemical reaction that takes out the nitrous oxide so that you're not producing so much nitrous oxide. And that's why it's a catalytic converter, and that's why it's so good for cutting down pollution and why you have it on your car. But it turns out that those metals are worth more than their weight in gold, right?
Yeah, a lot more, right? I mean, there's like, I don't know, the palladium's like $2,300, whereas gold is $19. And
yeah. And so the question comes, you know, what does that mean? And I guess I would present the thesis that this is an example of how these exotic metals that you never have a brick of palladium in your house or a piece of you don't make a lawn chair out of palladium, right? You make a lawn chair out of something ordinary like aluminum, not palladium. These things are incredibly valuable in these high-tech operations, and particularly are incredibly valuable for things like renewable energy systems, like making wind turbines, making solar panels, and in particular making car batteries, right? And we've talked before about how this metal called lithium is extremely valuable for making the lithium-ion batteries. And now that President Biden is pushing electric vehicles, like we spoke about last week, and we have renewable energies by 2035, we're going to be 100% renewable energy. All of a sudden, the demand for these exotic materials is going to go up by a factor of 6. Right, so all of a sudden we need more and more palladium, and the question is, where do you get it? Right, so it's I think that the mining. So what it brings you to is that in order to stop global warming, in order to do the right thing, you have to go out and scour the earth to mine these strange metals from different places. Right, and that's kind of the fundamental conundrum. There's a report from a consulting group called Ernst & Young. I don't know, you probably have seen them advertising on the Sunday morning talk shows back in the day, right? They're this big consulting group. But they put out a report that said there were three major reasons why mining for these exotic materials is difficult. And those three reasons are politics, price, and recycling, ESG things. It turns out that most of the material that we want to make solar panels and car batteries comes either from China or from Chile, right? Places that are not very politically powerful and are subject to extraction. I mean, you can think of the movie Avatar, right, where the big companies came in to take over the little blue planet, right? I mean, and it turns out that China is already leading in battery productions, and they've already got like long-term contracts with all these guys. So there's this huge political security implication for the production and, you know, getting our hands on these metals, right?
Right. Yeah, and I mean, just to be clear, you know, I think that harvesting these metals is destructive to the environment, but of course, so is harvesting fossil fuels. And you need less of these for solar panels and less of these for the batteries. But of course, as the production of batteries and solar panels increases, you need more and more. So right. It's not to the level of destruction, I think, that we're doing like the mountaintop removal and the big wastelands that you could create often with fracking and stuff like that.
I think it's a real thing that we're going to have to deal with. I mean, the other reason that it's really hard to get to these metals and to have a steady supply. So, of course, from the United States national security perspective, we want a steady supply of platinum and lithium and be able to go get it where we want it. Turns out that because the price is so volatile and the lead time for building the mines and processing, all that kind of stuff, that's so long, it's very hard to get capital to invest in making these, you know, your favorite palladium mine, right? I mean, it's just not really, it takes a lot of money, it takes a long time to earn back your money. So the people with the money are not that interested in tying their money up, which is an interesting case. I think we talked for a while ago about green banks and how the U.S. government could, you know, invest in long-term, thoughtful uses like that.
Yeah.
And the last reason that there is such difficulty in getting these exotic metals like lithium and whatnot that you need for batteries is because of the environmental safety, sustainability, and governance issues that we talked about, right? The extraction's dirty, damaging, and it may not be quite as bad as fossil fuels, but if you're living in the high Andes, it can be pretty. I mean, it turns out there are the lithium salt flats in the high Andes. And one article I saw said that it takes 2 million tons of water to produce 1 ton of lithium.
Wow.
Just like, holy mackerel, right?
Do you know how much lithium, like, you might need in, say, I don't know, a solar panel array for a house?
For scale, I think like your Tesla probably runs on several hundred laptop batteries, more or less equivalent. I think so they have something about the size of a laptop battery chained together, and your laptop battery probably, I don't know, a tenth of the volume of the laptop battery is lithium.
Yeah.
Right. So maybe you need about 1/10 of a car battery in order of pure lithium, right? That's just a wild guess.
Right.
I mean, it's not insignificant.
Right. True.
And the
what I had read about was that a lot of places are trying to sort of, like, you take a car battery, and then when it is no longer a lithium car battery, and when it's no longer powerful enough to power the car, it still has a lot of juice in it, and then you can use it to power your computer, right? So the idea of continually using these batteries as they sort of reduce their viability but still have some viability left helps minimize how much we need to extract. And I think there's a lot of ideas going about how to create more of a circular economy around the battery use and technology.
Absolutely. I mean, there is we may get to it later, but there's a call to say that even today, before we take another step, we should be designing the car batteries and your laptop batteries, design it for recycling, right? To make it easy to open up, to make it easy to get the lithium out of it so you can use it someplace else. So that after you have a system in place that uses that battery until it's completely exhausted, right? You've gone all of the repetitive cycles of, where you use it in the car, and then you use it and to store to the grid, and then you use it in some backwards operation, and finally the thing doesn't work after 20 years. You still have a way to get the lithium out of it. And those kinds of calls are, and I guess that leads to the other important idea here. So, dear listener, where we are is we're saying these exotic metals are important for addressing climate change. Okay. Getting the metals, just simply getting our hands on the metals, can be damaging to the environment, can be expensive. And we need to start thinking now about how we're going to get the lithium in a way that's fair, sustainable, just, and doesn't screw things up more than they already are. And that leads us to an interesting idea, is that in France, so Mariah, do you want to tell a story about what's going on in France, or do you want me to tell a story?
Yeah, no, it's very cool, right? They've got this, I think it's already online, but they're not going to enforce it with fines until maybe next year. But at any rate, they have this new repairability index, they call it. And it sort of addresses this problem of planned obsolescence, right? We know that planned obsolescence is that a lot of manufacturers, companies will create a product that they know will break in 2 years, so that you're forced to continually buy something new. And so France is going to put on this, they're requiring products to have a repairability index on them. And I think it's a value from 1 to 10, with 10 being it's the most repairable thing you can have, and 1 being it's going to break in a minute. Yeah. And the idea is that this will force, kind of send a market signal to make things that are renewable, that you can, repurpose, that you can keep them going, that they're easily fixable, and so on and so forth. And I think the idea is that it's will sort of spur a transition to a more circular economy. And also the world is watching to see if this works in France. And the hope is that other countries will say, oh yeah, France did that, and that, worked. Let's try it.
And the connection to the whole thing here is that there's a lot, for example, if you think of your iPhone or your Galaxy, there's a lot of exotic material in there. You may not appreciate it, but there's a lot of exotic wacko stuff in your phone. And the longer you can use that phone, the less demand there is to go dig up lithium in the high Andes, right? And so the whole question of repairability, I think that the experiment in France is exactly that. It's not even the EU, it's France national legislation, but it's these baby steps towards, as you say, market signals to try and get companies to make things that are repairable, fixable, that will have a longer life, which of course is much in keeping with the kind of future that we all have to start thinking about, where we use everything for as long as we can to reduce the impact that we would have on the world, right?
Yeah.
So I think that but I guess for me, the question, so all of this kind of sums itself up in the following question that I had, Mariah, which I don't have an answer to. But if there were some magical way that Elon Musk could come to you and say, here's your new Tesla vehicle. I have this certificate that says all of the lithium in this car was sustainably produced. It was recycled from some other, in a very nice way, all a very gentle way. You can feel good about driving this new Tesla off the showroom floor with all this green lithium in it. Would you pay a premium for that? Right? And you don't have the answer. I'm not sure what my answer is.
It's funny. I wouldn't even pay a premium for a Tesla. because there's other electric models out there, right? So I guess it depends on, is there another choice that is just as sustainable, but, it doesn't cost as much. So,
but take it to another place. Suppose either the Apple or Samsung could offer you an iPhone that was produced sustainably, right? Because you hear these stories of people jumping out the window at Foxconn over in China as they're making your iPhone. Right? Yeah. Like, oh, I feel good about that, right? If you could pay more for a for stuff, that, these exotic materials that are sustainably sourced, would you? I think that's where the rubber hits the road. You know, would you? Would. And I'm just putting that out there to sort of plant the seed in my own head, I guess, of like what, because then it becomes one way to guarantee that, you know, the Chevy Bolt has green lithium in it is because people are willing to pay for it.
Yeah. Although I mean, it's a balance between that and it should just be it's what's required, right? Yeah. You know, instead of forcing the decision and the cost of it to be put onto the consumers, you push it back onto, you know, the innovators, the research and design teams. They need to figure out ways to make this cost effective and also socially responsible or environmentally responsible, so that they're absorbing the externalities instead of pushing it onto the consumers.
And I agree. And I think that, I mean, to go one step further, we talked, as I said, a few shows ago about green banks and like the idea that the U.S. federal government should set up a fund to invest in long-term, relatively, you know, long-term return investments. I mean, but producing sustainable exotic metals seems like a place the government should step in and be ready to help out, because that's in everyone's interest and nobody wants to pay the money up front to figure out how to do it.
Yeah.
All right. So there's an idea, dear listener. There's an idea. There's one other thing that's worth talking about, because this is now the 17th of February. If you haven't checked on the news lately, you'll see that it is cold. I mean, seriously cold in the middle of the country, right? My brother-in-law lives in Minneapolis, and it was 20 degrees below zero there. Mm-hmm. And much of that cold weather has extended down as far as Texas. And in Texas, it is in the teens. Right?
Yeah, I heard 4 degrees. I heard it was 4 degrees in Texas on the same day it was 40 degrees in Alaska.
unbelievable. Well, not, I say unbelievable. I sound like a weather forecaster. I mean, probably in the age of global warming, you shouldn't be surprised that really weirdo weather things happen. But what's happening is that in Texas, for various reasons that we probably don't have enough time to get into, but for various reasons, the electricity grid in Texas is essentially shut down and people are in their homes freezing, literally freezing. And that has sparked a huge debate about windmills in Texas. And of course, this is being used, the events in Texas are being used by nefarious people to say, wind turbines are terrible, they all froze up. And I think we'll talk more about this in the future, but I think that the circumstances in Texas are because Texas hasn't planned properly, because all the wind turbines up in Minneapolis are still going along just fine, right? They have the antifreeze kit, whereas down in Texas, they didn't buy the antifreeze kit. Yeah. And from what I can glean so far, most of the majority of the power produced in Texas is produced with natural gas. And it's the natural gas plants that have all clunked off in the cold, not the wind turbines.
Yeah. And I heard the coal froze too somehow.
Yeah, right. They can't dig it out because it's all frozen.
It's all frozen, yeah.
And then the kicker on the whole thing, just because I didn't know this until the last couple of days, but because the Texans are so independent and think so highly of themselves, they have chosen not to be part of the national electric grid, right? Because so that they don't have to submit to federal guidelines. So Texas is its own grid. And when it collapsed, it's like on its own. It's kind of like Puerto Rico. It's its own little island, and you can't pump any power in or out. And there you go. The rich guys are making more money, and it's like, wow.
I have to say, we had like a 1 hour power outage at my house on Sunday, and I remember thinking, oh my gosh, it's 9 degrees outside. What am I going to do as our heat slowly starts to disappear? And fortunately the heat came back on, but I just can't imagine what people are going through down there where they're not used to that kind of weather. They have no heat. They can't really manage the ice and the snow and the cold. And like you said, they're not planned. They haven't planned for the resiliency of, you know, how do you make sure your energy producing systems can handle ice? Because they've never really had to think about that before. I mean, they have, but not like this. So it's really sad. It's really hard.
I mean, I guess the take-home lesson for the moment is that as I said, I'm sure this will blossom as a conversation over the next week, but this is not proof that renewable energies are a failure, right? Please do not take that lesson, despite what you may hear on certain news channels or whatever. That's not the take home from this. It's a much bigger story, right? Yeah,
you're going to plan for resiliency.
The other thing I just wanted to mention is that right here in Massachusetts on March 4th, Thursday, March 4th, there is going to be a virtual lobbying day. That is to say, there will be Zoom meetings that you can join with your state representative or state senator to lobby for environmental justice, you know, improved building standards, 100% clean energy here in the state of Massachusetts. It looks like it's going to be a great deal of fun. I'm going to put up the links as to how you can sign up on the blog at massclimateaction.org/blog. There's training sessions. There's one training session you can sign up for so you know what to do. And then there's Zoom meetings, which look like they would be a blast. So I urge you, this is a fun thing to do if you're sitting around watching the snow fly and have nothing else to do. You can virtually lobby your state rep. You don't even have to drive into Beacon Hill. Okay. So there you go. What we'll do is we'll put up links to all that on the blog at massclimateaction.org/blog. If you have any questions, please send us a question at podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what we should be talking about. Remember, you can find this show on your smartphone using any of the modern podcast distribution apps. Please ask your friends to find us on theirs. We want to thank our friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. We want to close where we always close by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. Because of that, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our future. So, Mariah, thanks so much for talking.
Thank you.
Thanks to everyone for listening. See you again next week. Bye-bye.
Very cool.